The final case this morning is Julie Behrens Leroy et al. Versus Alan Yersek and Merkin et al. Going first on, this is confusing to me, and perhaps we can get this all straightened out, is Paul Giorgiani on behalf of the appellant, cross appellees, who I believe actually won in the Court of Appeals. So you can help straighten us out on the procedural posture and why you're going first.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I did have the initial appeal in this case. It was on
Excuse me before you get started. I neglected to point out, as you would well imagine, our rules do not permit Justice Cupp to get two bites at the apple on this case. He was on the panel on the Court of Appeals that heard this case. So he has recused, and sitting in his stead is Judge Bill Hoffman from the Fifth District Court of Appeals. Judge Hoffman, pleased to have you here, and I forgot to mention that you slid into Justice Cupp's chair. Go ahead.
Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer. I did have the original appeal here. It was on a technical matter that the Court of Appeals rendered moot by reconsidering and correcting its opinion. We were here only on the defendant's cross appeal, and my understanding is, as under the rules, I still, because I am nominally the appellant, still going first. Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer. I intend to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. May it please the court, this case presents three legal issues. Two are fascinating and complex. One of them is mundane and very easy. And what this court should do is adhere to the doctrine of judicial restraint, decide the simple, mundane question, which is dispositive of this entire appeal, resolve just that issue, and affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. The mundane and easy issue in this case is whether the facts in this appeal satisfy the collusion or bad faith exceptions to the rule, the exceptions to the rule of attorney immunity in Simon v. Zipperstein. Now, the facts in this case, in this appeal, consist of two things. One, all of the allegations expressed in the complaint, and two, the entire universe of reasonable inferences one might draw from those express allegations. The complaint expressly alleges that the defendants colluded with Dan Behrens and Kevin Behrens, who were their other clients, and that they did so in bad faith with perfect knowledge of all of the relevant facts. Further details provided in the complaint as to exactly what that collusion amounted to. That is all that my clients, Julie and Mary, needed to do to state a claim within the collusion and bad faith exceptions to the Simon v. Zipperstein rule of attorney immunity. This case is that simple. The court should do what indeed the Court of Appeals did, was say, yes, the complaint adequately alleges collusion and bad faith, and this court should just recognize that and affirm and rule the rest of the issues in this appeal moot. Now, should the court decide that it wants to address the privity issue, which dominates so much of the defendant's brief, allow me to address that.
Well, if we were to go the route you want, does that leave it for the trial court to rule again on the privity issues? I mean, are those privity issues still alive and kicking and not resolved because we've chosen to only rule on the collusion issue?
Your Honor, this case is the subject of a conditional settlement. There will be a nominal remand, but under the settlement agreement of the parties, there will be no more further activity in the trial court other than the ministerial acts of dismissal entries.
Why does that not render it moot then, if there's no present controversy?
Well, Your Honor, the parties filed a joint motion suggesting something to that effect. The settlement is a conditional settlement, meaning the outcome of this appeal will determine exactly what trigger different provisions of the settlement agreement. Again, this court need not address the privity issue. I encourage it not to do so. It need not do so. If it does wish to do so, let me address that issue. Let me begin with a hypothetical which...
Well, let me interrupt you and ask, if we don't address the privity issue, does that affect the settlement?
Yes, Your Honor, that is one. The defendant's former counsel and I worked as hard as we could to make sure that the settlement agreement covered every eventuality, depending on the various permutations of results and
so I take it they'll still want us to decide the privity issue regardless of the tentative settlement?
That's correct, Your Honor. Let me correct that. Not necessarily address it, no. And in fact, I'm advocating that the court not address it. You don't need to address it. The simple issue in this case is, was there bad faith pled in the complaint? Was there collusion pled in the complaint? Those are already exceptions under Simon v. Zipperstein. The court need not even take a second look at Simon v. Zipperstein, because that rule, the rule of collusion and bad faith as exceptions, are well established. A simple application of Simon v. Zipperstein resolves this appeal, and that's what I'm advocating.
Counsel, let me back you up just for a moment. We might extend time here a little bit. I'm not remembering what you apparently jointly submitted, and it isn't in the file that I read on the run-up to this. That doesn't mean I didn't read it at some point in time and even vote to decide some issue, but I'm not recalling it. I don't know about my colleagues. What was it that you filed with us regarding the provisional settlement?
It was a joint motion to have the appeal resolved in a very particular manner that would involve dismissing one. It was fairly complicated. It involved dismissing one of the cross appeals, I believe, rendering part of it moot, and just modifying the Court of Appeals opinion below.
Okay. Well, we'll obviously be able to find that. And did we rule on that or not rule on it?
The motion was denied by, as I recall, a 6-1 vote.
All right.
Who was the one?
I believe it was you, Justice Stratton, if I recall correctly.
Just the way our briefs come to us, it isn't in this file, so it wasn't certainly on the forefront of my mind as we were looking at this. Let me ask you this. There are two different allegations by your client. One relates to the sale of stock, and there one would normally assume that the sale of stock by even a majority shareholder in a close corporation, I'm taking you beyond where you want to go in this, unless it somehow damages the corporation, is of no interest or import to the other shareholders. And so the lawyer's work in doing that wouldn't give rise to any right to sue or any cause of action against the lawyers. If that's all you had, am I right? And assuming the majority shareholder is competent.
Not necessarily in every case, but certainly as a general proposition, I'd agree with that.
There just wouldn't be a cause of action.
I agree with that. And if I may, let me...
So does this case depend on, in terms of the underlying merits, which we may never get to, the fact that there is intertwined in this an allegation of incompetence that's in your complaint, by the client of the law firm, and secondly, that there was at the same time or shortly thereafter a change in the will which presumably affected your clients. Does that all need to be connected in order for there to be any standing to come against the lawyers on the issue of the sale of stock?
Your Honor, my clients have standing on three different bases. There are three different exceptions in Simon v. Zipperstein: bad faith, collusion, and privity, and my complaint adequately pleads all three, and that's why the court has the luxury of choosing any one of those three to decide the case. And again, I'm advocating that you take the easy route, collusion and bad faith. The bad faith and the collusion, I think, is demonstrated by a totality of the circumstances. I think all of the circumstances that you just specified and all the other circumstances specified in my complaint and all the reasonable inferences one might draw from those allegations all feed into this notion that the defendants clearly acted in bad faith and in collusion with two clients, indeed adverse clients. This is the most egregious collusion that a professional can commit. It wasn't that the attorney was merely colluding with some other person out there. The attorneys were colluding with the adverse party in a transaction. There's no more egregious collusion.
If we find that there was no privity, because I'm having a very hard stretch finding that a stock transfer and a will gives your client any standing on a privity basis. The Court of Appeals sort of leap of faith to make that stretch is very difficult to accept. However, it seems to me that you're arguing you don't need that. If there's no privity, you can still allege the exception, which is the fraud collusion exception, that gets you the ability to attack it as a third party affected by the transfer of stock or the will. Is that correct?
Absolutely right. That's what I'm advocating for. It's the simplest way for this court to decide the case. It's clean. There's going to be no controversy. It's going to be a perfectly clear opinion. Simon v. Zipperstein says bad faith and collusion are exceptions. This complaint pleads bad faith and collusion. That's the end of the analysis. Everything else is moot.
But it may be necessary to address the privity issue so we don't leave the Court of Appeals opinion out there with some case law that could be potentially bad case law, in our opinion.
That's a question of an erudite question of judicial philosophy. What does a Court of Appeals opinion mean when there's been a Supreme Court decision that doesn't address one of the issues that is addressed in the Court of Appeals
opinion?
Trust
me, parties will find it to mean a whole lot in subsequent cases.
Perhaps.
They will cite it over and over if we don't address that proposition.
Perhaps.
As well.
I think the doctrine of judicial restraint, however, says the court decides what it should have decided or what it needs to decide and no more. Let me address your substantive concern, though. Let me, if I can, provide the court with a hypothetical that I think is the simple elementary illustration of why there needs to be a privity exception to the Simon v. Zipperstein rule that would apply to a close corporation situation. That is where the privity arises from the controlling shareholder versus minority shareholder status. Imagine, if you will, a controlling shareholder in a close corporation who decides that it's time for a succession plan that's going to involve a close corporation agreement under Section 1701-591 of the revised code. It's a close corporation statute. And this controlling shareholder says to her lawyer, "My time's coming to an end. I'm going to be dead soon. We need a succession plan. I want you to draft a close corporation agreement. I know exactly what I want. I want to say X, Y, and Z. This is going to provide for all of the minority shareholders. They're all going to get shares, equal shares. It's going to benefit the company. It's going to benefit all the individual shareholders." Clearly, this is a succession plan involving an estate/succession plan involving a close corporation. The intended beneficiaries of that attorney's work are these minority shareholders. Imagine that the lawyer commits malpractice, doesn't act maliciously, doesn't act in bad faith, just commits malpractice. The shares, let's say, remain in that controlling shareholder's estate when she dies. The executor's not going to bring that malpractice claim. The executor is thrilled. The executor, on behalf of the estate and all the estate beneficiaries, are now wealthier. On what basis do these intended beneficiaries, these minority shareholders, sue the attorney? Because they're the only ones that have been injured, the only people that could possibly have a claim. And the answer is, it's got to be the privity, because that controlling shareholder owed a duty of the utmost good faith and loyalty to those minority shareholders under this court's Crosby v. Beam case. And so that's sort of the simple illustration why privity needs to be an exception here.
Yes, they owe a fiduciary duty, but they don't owe an obligation to pass all their inheritance on to the other minority shareholders. And you have to accept that proposition to accept your privity argument, that fiduciary duty extended to, and you're going to inherit from me, and my attorney's going to make sure you inherit from me.
Under my hypothetical, that's correct. One could modify the hypothetical that would probably address that issue. For example, if the minority, if the controlling shareholder tells the minority shareholders that that's what the plan is. In fact, indeed, if it's a close corporation agreement, the other minority shareholders are going to be signing this agreement. Maybe they rely on it. Maybe they've got some other basis for to resolve that issue, Your Honor. That's the simple example of why privity among close corporation shareholders should be a basis for an exception to the Simon v. Zipperstein rule. Now, why is it that we're struggling so much? You see us struggling?
Counsel, and because I probed you on the motion to for us to decide this or to drop this case, took up some of your time on a collateral matter. Let me take you right to the matter that you say should decide this, and this that is that you pled enough to get past a 12B6. And I have your pleadings in front of me, and they're unusual in this respect, that you cite the key case right in your pleadings and say, Simon doesn't apply, this fits within the exception. If I understand your opponent's position, I call it your opponent because in my mind they're really the appellant here. Their position is that you didn't use the magic words collusion or that you needed to say specifically collusion. And I don't see the words collusion here. Maybe they're here, but you lay out facts which suggest that.
Your Honor, I do so, more.
Yeah.
I do more than that. Paragraph 33G of the complaint, defendants committed some or all of the aforementioned acts, all of the acts in the entire complaint.
Collusion.
In collusion with Dan and Kevin. They had, and I allege that they had perfect knowledge. They knew exactly what was going on.
Am I wrong that that seems to be part of the dispute between the two of you? If their response is, if we decide it narrowly, just saying this is enough to get past a 12B6, their argument is you didn't plead enough.
That's what their proposition of law number two says. It's a red herring. Clearly, I've pleaded. If I had just pled, defendants acted in collusion, period, maybe there might be something to the argument that I didn't plead enough facts. I pled who they colluded with, how they did it, what they did. Short of alleging what was said in the room when they got together to conspire, I don't know what else I could say.
So counsel, your pleadings are more akin to collusion being a fraud as opposed to a bad faith.
I think it arguably is a fraud, but the controlling case here is Simon v. Zipperstein, and Simon v. Zipperstein has three exceptions. Collusion, let me rephrase, three exceptions. Bad faith, malice, and privity, and Simon v. Zipperstein expressly says that collusion is malicious conduct. So collusion is right there in Simon v. Zipperstein. There's nothing for us to debate. It's there already, and I've pled it in detail, and that's why this case, this appeal, could be resolved so very simply with all the other issues being rendered moot. If I may, I'll reserve the balance of whatever time the court would allow for a rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. McClure, on behalf of the law firm.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Tony McClure, and I represent the attorneys in this case who seek a reversal of the decision of the Union County Court of Appeals, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents this court with a critical opportunity to specifically define the requirements in Ohio for when a plaintiff who wishes to raise legal malpractice claims against somebody else's attorney, and that's in two separate ways. First, the court can draw the line and reject the abrupt expansion of Ohio law that the Court of Appeals attempted in this case on the concept of privity. And second, the court can hold that simply by pleading one word, collusion, in a complaint, a plaintiff cannot meet the standards for the standing requirement in this state. And I'd like to, and it's critical to note that this rule in Ohio does not provide complete immunity to attorneys from legal malpractice claims. In this very case, in fact, the personal representative of the estate had standing to sue. Now, this case is essentially a family squabble over estate planning issues. What we have is Mary Behrens, the mother, the decedent, who transferred some of her stock to her grandson. Her daughters are upset with that transfer, and so they seek to sue their mother's attorney for legal malpractice. And what their theory is that they are minority shareholders in a close corporation. Their mother is a majority shareholder in that close corporation, and therefore, they necessarily should have standing to sue their mother's attorney with respect to that transfer of stock. Now, the Court of Appeals in this case agreed with that theory. This was a broad expansion of Ohio law. This case presents an opportunity for this court to hold that a plaintiff's mere position as a minority shareholder in a closed corporation does not automatically confer standing to sue somebody else's attorney, to sue the majority shareholder's individual attorney.
Well, counsel, up to that point, I certainly would agree. I suspect you might not get much disagreement up to that point, but there's at least allegations that there's more to it than that. That the attorney's client was incompetent. These are the claims. That the client was incompetent, that the transfer was for less than full value, and that the will was changed at the same time by an incompetent client. I don't know if we have an explanation as to what that meant, but that the bottom line is all of this conducted together meant harm to the other heirs or potential heirs of Mrs. Behrens.
Your Honor, the complaint does contain those allegations, but those are not relevant to the court's decision in this case on the privity issue. What the court held was that the daughters pled that they are minority shareholders, their mother is a majority shareholder, and from this and nothing more, they should have the right to sue their mother's attorney with respect to the transfer of stock.
But Mr. McClure, if I understand Mr. Giorgiani's argument, it is that under Simon versus Zipperstein, while there is no relationship between the minority shareholders and the lawyer for their mother, the exception applies because this was collusion. And the allegation is at least that the collusion amounts to malicious conduct, which falls within the exception to allow this kind of lawsuit to proceed. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. It's important to note here that the court's decision on the collusion issue was with respect to the will only. There are two transactions at issue in this case. One is the will, and the other is the transfer of stock from the majority shareholder to her daughters, to her grandson. The Court of Appeals held on the collusion issue with respect to the will only. And so what we have here is a dangerous precedent set by the Court of Appeals on the privity issue. If this court does decide on the collusion issue one way or another, it will not have necessarily decided the other issue, which is the privity issue out there.
Well, does our ruling necessitate consideration of both, or is it necessary only to rule on one aspect?
I would submit, Your Honor, that the court should rule on both. And that is because, first, this involves two separate transactions. And so a ruling on the collusion issue.
When you say two transactions, you mean one being the modification of the last will and testament, and the other the transfer of the securities.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If I understand the posture of this case, the Court of Appeals decision on the transfer was not founded in collusion, it was founded in privity, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did the court make a conclusion that collusion did not apply in the transfer of stock, or is it just was silent on that?
It was silent.
And that was not appealed, at least to where it's still in this court
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that issue's res judicata. In other words, we only have before us whether privity arises out of simply the relationship and allows them to sue the attorney.
On the transfer of stock, that's correct.
Then on the will, we have a very different issue. They get to the will by alleging collusion. The Court of Appeals finds that collusion was sufficiently alleged, and ours is a legal issue as to whether they met the standard of sufficient pleading.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's just a narrow legal issue as, is there sufficient pleading to get them to the collusion issue on the will? And if we find there is, then it goes back for a decision on the will.
Say that again, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay, let me rephrase it. If we find that there's no privity, the stock issue's dead. It's over, correct?
Mm-hmm.
If we find there is sufficiently pled collusion, then it goes back to the trial court for a trial on collusion.
That's correct, Your Honor, with respect to the will, I would say.
Respect to the will only, because the stock issue hinges only on the finding of privity, because they did not appeal the lack of a decision by the Court of Appeals on collusion.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, early on you said that the personal representative of the estate would have standing to sue in a situation like this. Would the remedies for the disappointed heirs be the same in that situation?
I would say yes, Your Honor. What generally happens in estate planning cases such as this is that the personal representative of the estate sues. Say if there's a negligence in handling of the will, and the estate would sue, and any damages would go to the estate, and the claims would be funneled through the estate so that they can be then distributed to the correct heirs. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So what we have in this case is this precedent by the Union County Court of Appeals saying that a minority shareholder can sue and the attorney for the majority shareholder simply by their role. If this rule were to stand, what it would mean is that each time a majority shareholder seeks to transfer some of her stock and she seeks legal advice, that attorney is going to owe a duty of care to each and every minority shareholder in that corporation, regardless of their relationship and regardless of whether or not there may or may not be conflicting interests among those minority shareholders.
Wouldn't there be an obligation to fall within the ambit of Simon versus Iperstein in order to prosecute that case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand.
Well, you're suggesting that every time there's a transfer of stock in a close corporation, the minority shareholders have a cause of action against an attorney with whom they're not, doesn't represent them.
That's certainly what this decision is suggesting, Your Honor.
And I'm asking whether or not they have to fall within, as if I understand Mr. Giorgiani's argument, in the complaint, he alleged his right to do that arising out of our decision in Simon versus Iperstein and the exceptions that are carved out there, bad faith, collusion, or privity. And my only question to you is, this wouldn't be some blanket rule. It would only be the same following that you would have to have facts alleged under Simon versus Iperstein. So it's not what you're suggesting, it's wide open.
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that this court held that when a minority shareholder pleads that they have their role as a minority shareholder.
Pardon me?
I'm suggesting that the Union County Court of Appeals held that when a minority shareholder pleads their role as the minority shareholder and also pleads that there was a majority shareholder who transferred some stock,
yes,
there is necessarily always privity. And therefore, that minority shareholder always has standing to sue that majority shareholder's lawyer with respect to that transfer of stock. That's precisely what the Court of Appeals held in this case.
And regardless of whether there's fraud or collusion, the Court of Appeals did not include those in its finding of standing.
With respect to the transfer of stock, that's
right.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, I go back to the pleadings because that's all this case is about, isn't it?
This is certainly a motion to dismiss standing.
So it all rises and falls on the pleadings. These issues are all intertwined in the first count of the pleading, and that's legal malpractice. So as pled, the plaintiffs have wrapped the two together, the transfer of the stock and the changes in the will. So for purposes of 12b-6, if there's a valid claim or if they've alleged legal malpractice and they have the standing to bring that, doesn't it then move on to a later stage to unwind what's included in the damages and what isn't, and whether the stock transfer is in or out in terms of a measure of damages as they move forward? But it's all wrapped in one complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
One count for legal malpractice against these lawyers.
That's correct, Your Honor. But what we have is a decision by the court that held, that observed that they had pled minority shareholder, majority shareholder, therefore privity, and therefore standing to sue the majority's attorney. If this ruling stands, Your Honor.
They don't talk about privity in their complaint, I don't think, do they?
The allegation is that is based solely on the fact that the majority shareholder had a fiduciary duty to the minority shareholders under this court's ruling in Crosby v. Beam.
But it's wrapped together it's a series of paragraphs which outline what they claim to be the facts that occurred, and it's all folded into one claim for legal malpractice.
That's
correct. Which they say they have a right to recover.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what they needed to do was plead either of the two exceptions under Zipperstein, either privity or the malicious conduct exception. They have failed to plead either. I see that my time is diminishing here, and I would like to reserve my
take some more time, because I've allowed more time to your opposing counsel.
Let me ask you a question on that new time that Justice Pfeiffer gave you. There was some suggestion that there's an arrangement that this is all worked out and we should just take the very simple, mundane, as we're wont to do, just the mundane group, easy way out and just resolve this because it's all been settled anyway. What's your reaction to that and the stipulation, and what is your view on that?
Well, the reaction is that we've got this dangerous precedent by the Union County Court of Appeals.
You don't agree that we should just resolve it as Mr. Certainly Georgiou not, said on that issue?
Certainly not, Your Honor. We you can't let this decision stand in Ohio.
You think it's essential to reach the privity issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes.
What else? Anything else?
Well, we can talk about the collusion issue now, or I can reserve my remaining time.
Why don't you reserve that and we'll let Mr. Georgiani
thank you, Your Honor.
Back up to the podium for his concluding remarks. Go ahead.
Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer. I quoted for you when I was here a moment ago, paragraph 33G of the complaint, which says that all of the facts, all of the allegations in this complaint, all of the conduct of the defendants was done in collusion with Dan and Kevin. The collusion addressed all of the issues in the complaint, both relating to the stock transfer and to the will. Now, what happened here? The will was changed in November. This woman's on her deathbed. She's incompetent. A month later, all the stock, her only substantial asset other than her house, gets transferred to her grandson, who's 20-something years old, and he writes a promissory note for whatever the number was, I've forgotten now, $600,000.
You probably haven't forgotten. But.
$429,000.
Thank you. Yes, this was all wrapped up. This is all one big conspiracy. You can't separate them out. And in answer to your comments, Justice Stratton, at the risk of being flip, we don't care what the Court of Appeals said because this is de novo review. And I don't have an obligation, I don't believe, under this court's rules to appeal an issue that the Court of Appeals simply chose not to address because it didn't need to. I think all the issues of the court are...
The Court of Appeals decision seems to allow you to proceed on the stock issue on the issue of privity, not on the issue of collusion, and you didn't appeal that. So why, if we find there's no privity, why is there any claim left on the stock?
Because, Your Honor, in the Court of Appeals, I won everything. I got my complaint reinstated.
Okay.
There's nothing for me to appeal. I don't think I needed to address issues that the Court of Appeals expressed a rationale with respect to the will
with regard to
the stock transfer.
In your opinion, they essentially reinstated your entire complaint.
Sure.
Okay.
And as I said, I think that I win with regard to the stock transfer and the will, to the extent that you can separate them out, which I don't think you can, on all three bases, all three exceptions to Simon v. Zipperstein: bad faith, malice, and privity. Now, the fact that the Court of Appeals chose one of those rationales to address one part of this complaint and another to another, I don't think is res judicata, has precluded me from arguing anything. The remedies, if I can address Justice Lanzinger's question, the estate remedies are going to be different from my client's remedies here. An estate will suffer different damages potentially, and in actuality in this case. An estate, for example, with no assets might not have the motivation or wherewithal to pursue a claim. Now, certainly the probate code allows my clients as individuals to pursue a claim on behalf of the estate, but now it's on their dime. Secondly, the nature of the damages specifically would be different. My clients expended extraordinary effort and money to get the executor removed in this case. When this complaint was filed, it's pled in the complaint, the co-conspirator Dan, who was the orchestrator of all of this, was still the executor of this estate. And my clients had to fight tooth and nail to get him out as executor, including a day and a half hearing. My clients have incurred damages just getting that part of the conspiracy undone. That's damages that my clients suffered, not the estate. I'd also point the court out to Haddon View v. Coopers and Librand, a decision from 1982 where this court recognized that a limited partner could sue the partnership's accountant for malpractice, and this court recognized that aggrieved parties have their own remedy separate from the partnership.
If you could sum up fairly soon, I've been liberal in what we've allowed here because our rules apparently put this case in a posture in which it's difficult for us to, it's unusual when the winning party goes first. And so we're giving you extra time so we can help unwind that. If you have anything else to sum up, I'd like
I appreciate
to sum up
the court's lenience in that regard. Our courts of common pleas need to have the discretion to at least require defendants in a situation like this to answer the complaint and not just hide behind a rule of immunity, because that's where this case is right now. They haven't even had to answer the complaint and say, yeah, we did it, or no, we didn't. This is a corporation's attorney who sided with one minority shareholder against the two other minority shareholders, took direction from that other minority shareholder, all with regard to the stock of the controlling shareholder, while the controlling shareholder was incompetent and on her deathbed. And oh, by the way, that other minority shareholder from whom the defendants were taking direction, he was the attorney in fact and had owed his own fiduciary duty to his mother, the controlling shareholder. Let me point out one technical matter, Your Honors.
If you would, and then please sum up. Yeah.
There is an error in the complaint. There is a reference to the Ms. Behrens being the majority shareholder. In fact, the inventory of shares earlier in the complaint is the accurate one. She was the controlling shareholder and the plurality shareholder. It's of no moment here because Simon v. Zipperstein, Crosby v. Beam talks of controlling as opposed to just majority shareholders. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. McClure, I guess you get another bite at the apple here because of appeals and cross appeals. So if you would.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll be very brief. We definitely need to reconsider the Court of Appeals holding in this case because the courts in Ohio need guidance on the requirements for plaintiffs to plead facts that would allow them to sue somebody else's attorney. This decision by the Court of Appeals, if it is allowed to stand, would mean that lawyers for majority shareholders are going to owe duties of care to minority shareholders in Ohio.
Does that require any change in Simon versus Zipperstein, in your view?
No, Your Honor.
Just an application of it?
That's correct, Your Honor. What the Court of Appeals has attempted to do is broaden Ohio law. That's right. And what the ruling means is that majority shareholders in Ohio are going to have enormous barriers to finding adequate legal representation with respect to stock transfers or conceivably with respect to any other kind of transactions. And now very briefly on the collusion issue, we would only recommend that this court hold that a plaintiff cannot simply plead the word collusion in a complaint to withstand a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6 in order to satisfy this court's requirements to establish standing to sue somebody else's attorney. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. McClure. And we will obviously go back and look at that earlier motion that was filed with the court as well. The case is submitted, and the marshal will please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable